Hello and welcome to T-minus 12 from Fueling Endurance. I'm Alan McCubbin. I'm an accredited sports dietitian based in Melbourne and have almost two decades experience working with runners, cyclists and triathletes to help them stay healthy and optimize their performance from complete beginners through to professional and Olympic athletes. In the fourth of our special six-part podcast series, we'll catch up once again with our guest athlete Brett as he prepares for the 100-kilometer Ultra Trail Australia. We'll review Brett's progress with his sweat rate testing and gut training, his run through of his eating the day before the race, and start to lock in his race day nutrition plan as we enter the last month before race day. Remember, if you're racing Ultra Trail Australia or you have a different running, cycling or triathlon event coming up in May or June, you can follow along with us, implementing the same principles and strategies that Brett does to help you succeed at your event. Now, you'll be forgiven for being a little confused with the episode today. Originally, we'd planned to do an episode with distance runner Cassie Feehan around her story with supplements and inadvertent doping. Unfortunately, due to circumstances, we were unable to record that interview in the end. So instead, we're bringing this one forward a week, which actually better aligns these discussions with Brett with the actual countdown to race day. So we'll be back with another question to answer for the podcast next week, and I'll tell you about that at the end of today's episode. So with all of that said, let's catch up with our guest athlete, Brett Kennedy, and see how things have been going. Okay, welcome back, Brett. Another couple of weeks since we last caught up. How have things been just in terms of your day-to-day training and nutrition? You're fairly happy with everything and how it's all planning out? You've got, what, about five-ish weeks until UTA now?
Yeah, they put up 1 month to go the other day, so that means it's getting real. Yeah, just hitting a couple of, I suppose, peak weeks right now, or just, yeah, bigger volume. Yeah, I did have some kind of a tempo block a little bit earlier, and it feels like that, I don't know whether it's just the cooler weather or whether that fitness is starting to set in a little bit now after a few weeks, but yeah, I just really enjoy my running at the moment, actually, so getting a few runner's highs, which is
good. Yep. Awesome. Must be all those carbs that you're taking during those sessions as well with your gut training.
That's it.
Yeah. The other things to review were what we introduced in the last episode, namely sweat rate testing to help us plan Brett's fluids for race day, as well as getting him started with some gut training, especially because nausea has been a significant issue for Brett at past events. So let's catch up again with how that's been going since last time, starting off with the progress made with his gut training over the past 4 weeks. Last time we spoke, you were already doing fairly well with that. You know, you were up to sort of 80, 90 grams an hour of carbs, which is probably plenty for your event. And I think you'd been working on a bit of the eating specifically just before a session. How has that been going? Are you starting to feel sort of more comfortable eating and then running straight away?
Yeah, definitely. Just have been using maltodextrin and then just something to eat as well before some of those bigger runs, particularly in the morning where, you know, ideally you'd like a little bit more of a turnaround time, but I'm getting up early as it is. So it could only be 45 minutes, half an hour, and I'm out of the trail. So I'm finding that's sitting all right. And yeah, just in my, most of my runs I'm fueling in some way. Like I did an easy run last night and just took a 90 gram precision hydration gel with me, just, you know, get through that. Whereas, you know, I might have just had one 30 gram gel in the past or for my sessions, taking a just little handheld with some carbs in there. So just really trying to, get the body used to, if I'm moving, there's some carbs coming in too.
All right. So Brett's gut training is going really well, and this will hold him in great stead for race day. So let's shift focus now to the topic of our last episode, where we put together a plan for Brett for the day before the race. The day before stuff that we worked on last session, we sort of looked at what you're eating the day before the race and then race morning. Did you have a chance to try that out before, like a long run session over one of the weekends just gone?
I've not simulated the full day yet. I've kind of done like a half, and that's really just been based around the intention was to, and some family things come up that, yeah, it just kind of threw that out the whack. But yeah, this weekend, that is the intention, is to have just a full day of that plan you've provided and then hit the trail Sunday morning and see how we go.
Yep. And what's the initial impression just from trying even like half a day of that? Do you think the volume of food and the types of food is going to work, do you think?
Yeah, I think having the certainly drinking a decent amount, I guess, of those carbs through the maltodextrin, consuming it that way helps. And then you do have, you know, your rice and meat and that to offset that sweet. So yeah, like kind of getting that balance. Once I settle into the runs, like the energy, you know, there's no ups, downs. Like I'm not hitting a session like a bullet, a gag. You know, it doesn't give me that feeling. I just noticed that I actually probably feel, if anything, not flat, but just kind of just so-so. Maybe I'm just trying to, maybe I think mentally, I assume that I would be feeling, you know, really, really up and ready to go. But once you get going, then you just settle in and, you know, there's no up, down. It's just smooth sailing. So that's, you know, and that's what you want. You don't want ups and downs. So
a bit of homework there for Brett to do the full run through of his eating the day before the race. But the real meat and potatoes of this episode is pulling together Brett's race nutrition plan. Now, this takes all the work that he's done in recent weeks around trying different race foods and fluids, the gut training to see how much carbs is realistic during the race, and of course, the sweat rate testing he's been doing to understand his fluid needs. So let's have a listen as this starts to all come together into a bit of a plan for race day. So you've done some great work over the last few weeks of collecting some data around how much fluid you've been losing during those runs. And so I'll pull that up here so we can have a look at it. So talk us through these different running sessions. How have these kind of compared in terms of intensity compared to what you would expect to do on race day? Are these being kind of at a round race pace or a bit above, a bit below?
Most kind of fall within, like they're all kind of zone two, like 140. It seems like 142 beats per minute seems to be the average across, like in nearly all of them. So I would assume that maybe is ideal race pace, like an ideal spot to be, or, you know, just a bit more casual than that. But then at the same time, I've just got to run my own race on the day and not get too caught up in everything else. But yeah, ideally, that is how I'll be moving in May.
Yeah. Okay. And just looking at the temperatures across those, they vary from sort of as low as 11 degrees Celsius up to about 22. And I guess thinking about UTA, it's probably kind of what you'd expect. UTA might be a little bit cooler, just depending on luck, you know, what weather you get on the day. But that's probably within the conceivable range of what you'd get up there.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, that's what the weather app was saying. But then the feels like for a lot of them was a few degrees cooler again, or some of those that, you know, that the hottest afternoon there was running into the night as well. So yeah, I think I've tried to capture at least a good mix anyway, because yeah, you do get those a bit more heat in the valleys and then it is a bit cooler up top on the cliffs. So
yeah. And so if we have a look at your sweat rates here, they do follow a neat pattern in terms of the coolest ones you are seeing the lowest sweat rates and the hottest ones you're seeing the sort of the higher sweat rates. So that's not surprising. Obviously, if they were big differences in intensity, you would see big differences there. Like if you know, some of them were interval sessions, you would expect a higher sweat rate compared to just the easy sort of zone two runs and things like that. But yeah, we're seeing a variation from the lowest was about 1,000 mils an hour, so a liter an hour, up to just over 1.5 liters an hour, which I think for ultra running, I would say is a little bit on the higher end, but I suspect the reason for that is, you know, you're quite tall, Brett, and so there's a lot of you to carry around, so to speak, and, you know, the amount of calories you basically expend when you're running is proportional to both the pace but also your body weight. And being taller, you obviously have more weight to carry around, and because of that, you know, you have to burn a bit more calories than the average person who's a bit shorter to move at the same pace. And so you're probably burning more calories than the average person on a run, and therefore you're producing more heat than the average person on a run, because that's proportional to your calorie expenditure. And because of that, you know, you're producing more heat, you've got to get rid of that, hence the higher sweat rate. So that's generally what you see, is the bigger the person, the higher the sweat rate for the same pace. Obviously, it's pace dependent as well. So the next thing we look at when we look at these sweat rates is how much you're drinking compared to the sweat rate. That varies across the different sessions. I think one session was a shorter session. It was only an hour, so you didn't have anything to drink on that session, which is fine. It was sort of a measure of your sweat rate. You don't have to drink to do that measurement. The others vary from sort of 200 mils an hour up to about 450 to 500 mils an hour. Do you find that there's many situations where you are able to consume more than that, or do you feel that that starts to become, you know, gut tolerance becomes a limiting factor at that point? Or is it just that, you know, these runs are all less than 3 hours, so you just don't feel the need to drink as much because it's only 3 hours?
I do know the longer I go, especially once I start to get close to the 3 hour mark, I am drinking through more with these. I do a loop that is roughly around an hour or a bit, just a little bit longer for a lot of these runs in on that same kind of loop. And yeah, I just tend to kind of have some of my drink mix in one, but in a flask. So the idea is for each loop that should be emptied. And I also carry some water just to kind of sip when I'm having gels or the like as well. But I think really it just, I can drink more and I have drank more before, but yeah, it's not that it just tends to be what happens. I'm not feeling like I need to drink more, but I'm also not feeling like if I was that it would be a problem.
Yeah. And I mean, that's one of the tricky things. And I think one of the things that takes people a bit of time to get their head around is that the amount of fluid that you need to drink as a percentage of what you're losing. So for example, in these ones, you're sweating, you know, your sweat rate is between 1 and 1.5 liters an hour, and you're drinking between sort of 2 and 500 mils an hour. So if we frame that in terms of what percentage of your sweat loss did you replace, apart from that one session, the shorter one where you didn't drink anything, the other ones are all sort of between the lowest is about 20% and the highest is about 45%. So you're only replacing sort of 20 to 45% of the fluid you lose. But when you look at these sessions are all less than 3 hours because they're training, they're not races. And so if you have a look, you know, your body mass loss over those is all sitting between sort of 1% and 2%, or just over 2%, 2.2. And so that's an appropriate body mass loss to have for a session like that. So that would suggest that the amount of fluid that you're drinking is appropriate for that duration. But as you just said, as the duration starts to creep up, the relationship changes here because you have to start to replace a greater percentage of your sweat losses to still finish the thing at a 2% loss. So 2% loss over 2 hours, you only need to replace say around 30, 35% in your case. But once you start getting out to 15 hours to still finish at that 2% body mass loss, you're going to have to replace probably 80, 85% of that fluid loss. And so that's a big step up in terms of fluid volume because your sweat rate is relatively high. So for 15 hours, using the average of the sweat rates that you've captured so far, that's a fluid intake of, you know, replacing about 90%. And it's up to about, you know, a litre to 1.1 litres an hour of fluid intake, which is obviously quite a big step up. It's close to triple what you're drinking at the moment in many cases. And so it's probably something that we need to think about in terms of practicing that in training. So you're not necessarily that you have to drink that much in the training sessions to stay well hydrated, but you probably need to start thinking about at least getting your gut used to having that volume of fluid going in. Now, you may do that a couple of times and it's easy and you're like, fine, no problem. We don't need to necessarily train it hard. But there may be you try that and go, oh, gee, that's really hard to actually keep up with that fluid volume. And also thinking about it, you know, coming back to the persistent challenge that you've had in previous races has been nausea. I wonder whether actually you've ended up fairly dehydrated and that's maybe contributing to that nausea.
I wouldn't be surprised, and you know, I've just never had the data to kind of get anywhere close to it. But I certainly noticed with some of the symptoms that I do have, you know, around that time, would probably lean towards a dehydration. But
Okay. And if we look at sort of the additional data, we talked about this in the last session, as well as just, you know, weighing yourself before and after and working out how much weight you lost and how much you drank and therefore your sweat rate. the other bits of information we captured allow us to work out a couple of things. One is by capturing the amount of fluid you took with you and then what you drank from that, we can calculate, well, how much of the fluid that you took did you consume? Because that would suggest, you know, if you're consuming 90% of the fluid you took with you and it's still not enough, then you're just not taking enough fluid with you. And then that's a planning issue that we can work around. For you on these sessions, you were drinking sort of between sort of 60 to 65% for the more recent sessions and then up to 90% of the fluid in some of them as well. Were those more recent sessions, it sounds like there was more fluid available. Was that something that you'd sort of deliberately set up to have more access to fluid during those more recent ones?
Yeah, I think certainly the last two, but maybe the last three, I've also carried all my gear, all my race gear. So I'm carrying, for some of them, three or maybe four flasks completely filled. So just to add the extra weight as well. And I am just swapping them out, obviously, as needed. So yeah, I think probably what that reflects is it's just, I've got the four flasks, three or four of them, filled up. So.
Yep. Okay. And that makes sense because you're drinking a lower percentage of the available fluid because there is more fluid available. Yeah. Okay. The other bits of data that we talked about last time that I think are really useful to capture when you're doing this kind of testing, the first one is to capture a sense of what your thirst sensation is doing. So we do this on a 0 to 10 scale. So 0 is absolutely not thirsty at all. And 10, we found you in the desert after a week, something like that. So you've been rating the thirst at the end of these sessions at around a 5 or a 6, which suggests, there's some thirst there, but it's not unbearable or anything like that. And that probably reflects, the fact that your drinking is getting you to around an appropriate amount of body weight loss for the duration of those sessions. And then the final thing that we captured was gastrointestinal symptoms as well, just to get a sense of, is gut tolerance to the fluid actually one of the things that's limiting you at the moment? So we put this on a scale of, 10 would be, I can just gulp down whatever, and 0 is, no, it's going to come straight back up again. There's no tolerance there at all to fluid. And having a look here, you'd sort of rated those between sort of a 5 and a 7, which suggests that, it's not super comfortable, but not super uncomfortable either by the end of those sessions. Would that be a fair summation?
Yeah, if anything, I'd say it's on the lot, the tolerance is fine. It's not been too much of an issue.
Yeah, and we did collect some more detailed information about GI symptoms as well. And the pleasing thing is in the two most recent sessions, there were zeros all across the board for GI symptoms. Whereas a couple of, I think three sessions ago, there was some things going on there. But for the most part, they were fairly low, apart from that one session. And then the two most recent ones were down around 0, although interestingly, they were the two cooler sessions as well. Do you want to talk about that one where you did have a few more symptoms? Was there anything there that could have stood out to you as maybe why that was happening, or you're not really sure?
I'm very sure. That's March 31st was Easter Sunday. So there was a lot of family catch-ups and chocolate for breakfast. Just really was, I imagine with that one that I probably was just had eaten closer to the session, but not with the stuff that I've been filling with the other times. Like it was just, bigger meals, and it was a warm afternoon as well. So I think that combination, probably just set me up where I was. It was an uncomfortable run, but it was one that, never kind of stopped me, but I certainly was, not feeling comfortable throughout.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. So obviously it's only a sample size of one, but it's some nice evidence that Easter eggs is probably not a good pre-race food.
It's a good post-run.
Yeah, possibly. All right. So we've got a sense of what's going on with Brett's hydration needs for race day. We know from his hydration data that the amount of fluid Brett's been drinking has been adequate for his 1 to 3 hour training runs, but he'll need to up this on race day, as a 14-hour finish time will require a greater proportion of his sweat losses to be replaced so he doesn't end up becoming dehydrated. So the final phase of Brett's gut training will therefore focus on fluid volume to ensure that he can drink enough for the hottest parts of the race at UTA. Because Brett's quite tall, he carries a lot more weight than many trail runners, which means he has to work harder and therefore sweat more to maintain the same pace. So this is why his sweat rate is actually quite high for the type of running that he's doing. And it's why he's got some work to do to ensure, firstly, that he can physically carry enough fluid between checkpoints to meet his needs in the hottest part of the race. And secondly, that his gut can tolerate drinking these volumes. Now, they're not extreme by any means, around sort of 650 to 1,000 mils an hour, or maybe slightly more if it's a particularly hot day. And Brett has indicated that he has been able to achieve this level of fluid intake in other races in the past. But obviously, the more practice he gets, the easier it will be. And because the weather's cooling down at this time of year, he hasn't had that experience and that practice, and his gut getting used to that in recent times. So we're going to turn now to the race-specific planning. So for fluid, this includes practical things like how he's going to carry the fluid that he needs between checkpoints, and then how much of that fluid provides carbohydrate as well.
I definitely prefer flasks over a bladder. I do have a bladder, but UTA, you're already carrying a lot of gear in your back and just the refilling. I mean, it's, yeah, for me, I just find flasks very simple, and I've got, you know, lock caps on them so that I can carry liquid without the tops pinching and liquid squirting everywhere. So I do tend to, yeah, carry two flasks in the front, and especially for the more recent trainings, but I do it often, is the other two flasks I'll put, there's a pocket in the back. I've got a Salomon vest. There's a pocket down through the back. So I'll just stack them in there. Yeah, just the two in there. Because then I can just always just reach around behind me and pull one out. And yeah, that tends to be the way that I, yeah, carry that.
And what sort of volume are the flasks that you're using?
500 mils.
Yeah.
So okay, yeah, cool. 2 litre minimum for UTA. So that's how I...
Yeah. All right. Well, as we get through and start to put together sort of expected pace and time between checkpoints, we'll start to get a sense of whether that's going to be enough or not. I suspect in the heat of the day and some of the longer distances between checkpoints, if they occur around that time in the race, it may not be. And we might have to look at, you know, ways of either filling those bladders more regularly or carrying a bit more with you. Obviously, you don't want to carry more with you if you don't have to either, because there's just extra weight you've got to carry around. And we do find with some athletes, I don't think this will be an issue for you given your sweat rate, but we do find with some athletes that actually, because they carry so much, it actually encourages them to drink too much, and they end up sort of at higher risk of hypernatremia because it's easier to. And so, and we actually end up taking off fluid and carrying less with them because we don't want to encourage over drinking. But in your case, I think the reverse will be true, because you've got a combination of sort of that higher sweat rate and a preference not to use the bladder if you don't have to, will mean that, yeah, that might be a challenge that we have to think about as well.
Yeah. And I do have additional flasks, like Hutt to Hutt in February. That was obviously a hot race in the Alpine areas, and there were some sections there which I just had no idea how long it was going to take. So I was taking 5-6 flasks just to be safe, really, because there are some pretty remote parts out there, or whether I had drink mix pre-mixed in. And so I wanted to just carry those flasks with the liquid already in there rather than messing around. Yeah, so that's an option as well.
Yeah, yeah, cool. All right, so I guess the next part of this will be what goes into those flasks. So where have you kind of settled on? I know last time we spoke, you know, originally you were sort of trying the maltodextrin with various flavors added, and then you tried sort of the NARC mix because obviously that's what's being provided on course. And so if you can use that, that's advantageous, or even if it's a backup plan, it's still good to be familiar with it. Where have you kind of settled now? Because I think last time you were sort of saying you're getting quite used to that NARC drink mix and that might be an option for you. But yeah, another couple of weeks have gone by. Where have you kind of finally settled on what you think you'd prefer to use for the race itself?
A bit of a hybrid, really, is that I was probably thinking of having NARC for probably the first 3 to 4 hours to that mid-morning period. It's just a nice kind of non-sweet filling kind of flavor. Like it's, yeah, there's just something about it that sits well. But I just know that when I do start reaching that point of thirst, it's not something that I'm going to be wanting to, I guess assuming that at that point I probably will want to be moving to something with a bit more sweetness, which I use at Infinite Nutrition's GoFar. It's the other drink which I've used, and I've used in other ultras that's has gone well. So probably am thinking, yeah, looking at a bit of a mix with some NARC early, and then moving to infinite, depending on where, I guess we'll just see where the course lands.
Okay. And so we know in your scenario that because you have a higher sweat rate, you're going to have a higher fluid need. And one of the challenges when we're planning for an ultra is how you're going to get your carbohydrate in. Is it going to come through liquids? Is it going to come through solids? Usually it's a combination of those two, but what sort of combination of that? And does that need to change across the day as well, either based on personal preference or just the fact that your sweat rate changes over the day as well? So the way I would generally think about this is think about, you know, what's the minimum sort of fluid intake we expect you to need on race day. And that kind of puts a bit of a cap around carbohydrate, because the day may end up being cooler than expected. And so, you know, you may be sitting at around that sort of the lower end of that expected fluid intake for the whole day. And so you don't want to then be reliant on needing more fluid than that to get your carbohydrate in, because then you either, you're forcing yourself to overhydrate to get the carbs or under fuel to keep the fluid within, you know, what you need. So yeah, that's kind of how I would sort of approach that. So thinking about your fluid intakes and what we expect that might look like. We said before, you know, at the minimum would be around sort of 800 mils an hour or something like that. I'd probably tend to go a little bit less than that, just because again, it could turn out to be much colder than we expect. And so we want to sort of factor that in. So if we said that your sweat rate was maybe 20% lower than the lowest that you've measured so far, so maybe 800 mils an hour rather than 1,000, that would take your fluid needs down to around sort of 650, 700 mils an hour. So that's probably the base that we would use to plan your carbohydrate around, sort of 650, 700 mils an hour of fluid. And then any additional fluid that you drink can be carb-free fluid. And obviously how it works out on the day, how thirsty you are, how hot it gets, kind of will dictate how much of that extra fluid that you drink, but how much or little isn't going to change how much carbs you get. So it's not going to interrupt that kind of fueling process. So if we think about that sort of 600 and 700 mils, yeah, you're sort of talking 1 to 1.5-ish flasks. So then we're talking, what's that going to be, about sort of 70-ish, 75-ish grams of carbs per hour, potentially, that you could get from fluid. You don't have to, but you could if you wanted to. That's a reasonable amount, considering, you know, we've talked about probably about 70 to 80 grams an hour is probably as high as you need to go for a race like UTA. So yeah, I don't know. What's your feeling about solids versus liquids as your source of carbohydrate?
Yeah, I have typically used a mix, and I guess it's where in the past, obviously, I've had these issues, and not knowing the cause of these issues, there's that lack of confidence in what's the right approach. Am I better off having, you know, food or even just gels and the likes? Is that, or is liquid nutrition the preference, or can I do both? But I've not had the level of information that we've got currently. Everything else in the past has just been kind of just guesswork. What I tend to do is have a drink mix is probably 70% of what I have, say, per hour. And yeah, and then a gel or something as well every kind of 45 minutes or 40 minutes. That's just what I've done in the past. I've had that mix.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that probably fits with what we're seeing here. You know, you can probably get, 70 to like 1.5 flasks an hour. That's 750 mils an hour. So there might be times where it's a little bit less than that. But even if we said one flask an hour, like that's still getting you 55 grams of carbs. And so, yeah, that's, as you said, that's probably 70% of what you're having. If you're then having just one solid item, and with solid items, whether they're gels or whether they're real food, I guess the way I would tend to think about it is try to standardize the items that you're having in terms of the serve sizes, so they're all delivering about the same amount of carbs, and that way you can substitute things in and out. So you could have a gel or a sandwich or, you know, whatever it is, but they're all going to give you about sort of 20, 25 grams of carbs. So if you're like, don't feel like the gel now, let's have the sandwich instead, you know, you're going to get the same amount of carbs regardless, and you're not sitting there having to do a whole bunch of maths to go, well, one gel is equivalent to 1.5 sandwiches or whatever, so I need to eat 1.5 sandwiches instead of one. And it just, you know, 10 hours into an ultra marathon, you don't want to have to do maths, basically. So yeah, trying to come up with combinations. And so if you're having combinations that are around 20 grams of carbs, that's perfect, because that fits with your 55. It's going to give you 75 grams an hour of carbs. So that's probably about right, I would have thought. And it means that, you know, one of those options could just be more of that carb-containing fluid. And so that can be a fallback option if you feel like that's all you can get in at a particular stage of the race. And that's fine as well. So I think, yeah, one flask an hour for carb mix, and then one other thing, whether it's a gel or a solid item per hour, I will standardize those to around that 20 to 25 grams of carbs. Sounds about right. And does that sound realistic from your point of view and from what you've been sort of doing in training?
Like for me right now, and it's probably something I've done in the past and that's why it sticks out, but you know, I'm thinking, you know, is it that, yeah, it's 55 grams in one flask, which is also your 500 mils, and then the other flask is plain water. And you know, so every 2 hours you're having, every hour you're having half of your plain water. So as I sit here now, that's probably where I'm thinking, yeah, that would probably be the approach, and based on, yeah, how long you'd expect to go between aid stations to refill that plain water, for instance, you know, that probably works out not too bad, I think.
Yep. Yeah. What about the solids? So you've had a bit of a play around with different options. What are you sort of landing on now as your sort of your preferred options?
So I've been trying some small jam sandwiches without the crusts. I've used these in the races before, little muffins from Coles, the box of 9 mini muffins. They're probably the go-to. I've tried to find some, I mean, I know I want to eat salt mini chips, for instance, or just, you know, salty like crisps, that's not an issue either. I did try pretzels, but I'm not a big pretzel eater, and I just didn't really.
They're quite dry as well.
Yeah, it didn't really do much for me. I still am liking the NARC energy bars. You can just kind of just take a chunk, you know, put it back, take a chunk, put it back. And it is a bit more of that real food that for me has been sitting quite well. Doesn't make me feel like heavier or anything like that. Yeah, there's certainly, that's pretty, it's a small sample size, but a lot of those things, I mean, muffins, for instance, they're 20 grams of carbs or thereabouts, 19 grams. So it's all within that kind of range of what I'd be looking for if I'm looking to branch outside. One thing I haven't had, but I've had in the past, and I just need to buy a bag. I'll probably just get some lollies, lolly snakes, probably.
Yep.
That's something I know that in the past when I perhaps have kind of got off my gels or drink mix, I'm still able to just smash down a handful of lollies before I know I've got to climb or something, bit of a safeguard before I hit a hill. I know that that's not been a problem. So especially if you can sip it down with a little bit of water or something. So that's what I'm looking at.
Yeah. And the other ones that sometimes people find just for a bit of variety in flavors, so it's just not the same kind of sweet flavors all the time. Some people will go with like crystallized ginger type lollies to get that kind of very different flavor, or the really sour flavored, like you can get the sour squirm snakes and things like that. Just again, something that's not super sweet, that can be an option as well. I know Steph's a big fan of those. So yeah, that's another option that you could go with.
I do carry I've got uncrystallized ginger is my break glass in case of emergency if I get nauseous. I've had that in the past where almost instantly it's pulled me out of a deep dark hole. So I do rate that.
Yeah, cool. Awesome. All right. Well, we've got certainly plenty of options there, and I think they're all falling in around that 20 to 25 gram mark for a reasonable serving size, which is good. So yeah, we'll just start bolting those together in terms of options for the different checkpoints and the gaps between those. That's the fluid and carbohydrate locked in, at least the hourly intake rates. But what about sodium replacement? Running a 100-kilometer ultra, UTA is an example of an event where the amount of fluid and sodium lost, and also the amount of fluid that can and should be replaced, can start to dilute the sodium in your blood, requiring sodium intake to offset those losses. Now, I said before on the podcast that for me as a sodium researcher, sodium replacement during exercise is not necessarily about replacing the total sodium losses, it's about balancing the fluid replacement. And so the more aggressively you replace a fluid loss, the more sodium is needed to balance that out. So let's hear our brief discussions now around sodium as well. We haven't actually done a sweat sodium test with you. There's no sort of facilities out your way that can do that easily. But what we can do is we can put in some hypothetical scenarios based on sort of the average sweat sodium concentration and then maybe a worst case scenario, you know, high and low kind of thing. And that will give us a bit of an idea around sodium needs as well. So for most people, the average kind of sweat sodium concentration across the whole body, because it does vary across different body parts, but if you take it across the whole body, is around sort of what we call 40 millimoles per liter. Now, if you want to convert that to milligrams per liter, you multiply by 23, basically. So we can put that in as a hypothetical scenario. We can put in also a higher value, so maybe up to sort of 60, 65, which would certainly be well above average, but certainly not at the absolute extreme that we might see. So we can put those in, and then we can put in the rest of your data and get a sense of what that looks like in terms of electrolyte needs. Now, just remind me, Brett, expected finish time for UTA?
I'd love to say 14 hours. My silver buckle.
Yep. There you go. Let's put in 14. So based on that and those two sodium requirements, obviously, if you've got the high sweat rate combined with the very high sweat sodium concentration, that creates a pretty high need for sodium replacement, you know, up to sort of 1800 milligrams an hour, which is quite high. If you take kind of the lower end of that sweat rate and an average sweat sodium concentration, it comes down significantly, down to about 500 milligrams per hour. Now, people might have heard in the podcast talking about the fact that in a lot of cases you don't need to replace sodium during exercise. It's the fact that it's 14 hours that means, you know, you need to drink enough fluid over those 14 hours to not become dehydrated. And when you drink that much fluid, eventually you will start to dilute the sodium in your blood just because of, you know, the percentage of the fluid that you need to replace. In this case, it's up around sort of 85 to 90% just because of the duration of the event. So that's when in the ultra distance events, yes, sodium replacement does start to become more important, whereas in shorter events, you know, your road marathons, your half Ironmans and things like that, much less important. So does that all kind of make sense to you, Brett, in terms of that relationship between how much you're drinking versus how much you're sweating and the fact that as you go longer, that relationship changes?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And I mean, like I said, I'm in the runs as I go longer, I know that feeling of thirst, yeah, intensifies. I'm definitely looking for more liquid once I hit the 4 hour, 5 hour, especially if it's a morning into a middle of the day scenario. Yeah, like I've seen that anecdotally every time. So,
yeah. All right. Well, we'll leave it there then. I think that's given you more than enough to keep going on with. We'll get that spreadsheet set up with all your expected paces and checkpoints and times and things like that, and that'll start to pull that plan together in terms of how that translates into how much between each checkpoint. Plenty to do, plenty of training to do, I'm sure, let alone nutrition, but it's all part of the bigger picture. So thanks for joining us again, and catch up with you in a couple of weeks. So you can see there's a bit more work to be done before we can completely finalise Brett's race nutrition plan. We need to map out the course for UTA, the aid stations, and his expected pace, so we can work out how much he'll need to carry between each checkpoint. But we can already say with some confidence the types of foods and drinks he'll be using, and the quantities he'll need per hour, and he can really focus on that in training over the next couple of weeks while we finalise this spreadsheet to actually work out how much between each checkpoint. So that's our fourth session with Brett all done. The next episode will be our final one before race day and our final chance to catch up. So Brett is going to trial his full nutrition plan for the race as a dress rehearsal for UTA. We'll also discuss the training taper leading into race day and how to handle that from a nutrition perspective, and discuss contingency planning for when things don't go as planned during the race. Because in 100k ultra, one thing you can almost guarantee is that things won't go according to plan at some stage. Now remember, if you've got a race coming up around May or June, you might like to go through the same steps that we've just discussed today with Brett in preparation for your event. And if you want more details about nutrition for ultra distance racing, especially if you're training for your first, you can go back and listen to episodes 12A with Steph Gaskell and myself, as well as episode 12B with elite ultra runner Kelly Emerson, 12C with elite 24-hour mountain biker Kate Penglaze, and episode 12D with Ironman legend Kevin Ferguson. Now, the next episode of Fueling Endurance will be answering a new question, and the question we're going to have a look at is, how do my nutrition needs change at altitude? Now, this will cover not only training and racing at a high altitude, but also the effect of altitude training tents, which are becoming increasingly popular, and the impact that being at real or simulated altitude has on nutritional needs. And we'll be joined by a returning guest, Becky Hall, who has previously worked with the Olympic Winter Institute of Australia, but has also been involved in nutrition research projects that have been run in conjunction with altitude training camps. Finally, a reminder that if you have a question you'd like answered on the podcast, you can contact us at Fueling Endurance on Instagram, Facebook, or Threads, or Fuel Endurance on Twitter. And remember that there's already been 75 previous questions that we have answered on the podcast. So if you are new, welcome. You might like to go and check out the back catalogue to see if there's something there that will be helpful to you. If you want to be notified every time a new episode is available, you can hit subscribe on the podcast app that you're listening to this on. And you can get your hands on the Fueling Endurance ebook, which provides written articles to cover the first 2 years of the podcast. And you can get your hands on that through fuelingendurance.com or via Amazon for the Kindle version of that ebook. But that's a wrap on today's episode. Hope you found that useful in planning for your own events coming up. We'll catch you next week when we have our discussion with Becky Hall.